I'm Michelle Martin of NPR News, and along with St. Louis Public Radio and Reverend Willis Johnson, we welcome you once again to Wellspring Church in Ferguson, Missouri. We are here for another community conversation, and let me say that I know that there have been many conversations since we last met in this space after the events of last August that we all know so well. So what do we hope to accomplish with this conversation? Well, we hope that this is an opportunity to hear from some who have been very involved in a public way in trying to learn from all that has happened and to learn about all that is happening. We also hope this is an opportunity to hear from those who have perhaps not had a chance to participate in other conversations. I'd want to thank, again, Reverend Willis Johnson for allowing us to have this conversation in the church that he leads. He is not only going to host us here, he's going to kind of help me see if we're not hearing from everybody who needs to be heard from throughout the course of the 2 hours, so thank you for that. I want to say once again that we are recording this conversation for broadcast on St. Louis Public Radio. It is likely to be slightly edited for space. I'd also like to say once again that I have been asked by St. Louis Public Radio to moderate this conversation, and in that role, my job is not to take sides, not to judge the situation, but rather to help us have a good conversation. What do I mean by a good conversation? I know that people have different things in mind when they hear a good conversation. What I mean by that is that I hope we have a conversation where we can hear each other. Sometimes that can be hard to do, but I know we can do it because we have done it, and I know that you are all going to help me. I also want to make it clear that the people on this panel are not the sum total of all the voices and ideas that we want to hear about or the people we want to hear from. These are people who've been very publicly involved, and they're here to kind of help us get started and guide us and give us their wisdom. But all of us here matter, and all the voices in this room matter, and we want to hear from as many of you as we can. Reverend Johnson's going to help, too, and I'm just going to start by asking him to offer a brief word of welcome to our broadcast audience. Would you do that?
Well, again, Ms. Martin and to the NPR family, we welcome you to the well. It is with much enthusiasm, and we greet you in peace on behalf of the millions of United Methodists around the country and the globe, as well as the Conference of Missouri, and specifically the friends, the family, and leadership of Wellspring Church, this community that we call home. We welcome you to Ferguson and to the well.
All right. Well, thank you for that. Let me share with you who is here, especially for those of us who, those in the broadcast audience, as you just heard from the Reverend Willis Johnson. He is the pastor of Wellspring Church in Ferguson, Missouri. He has more than 15 years of experience in ministry in Indiana, North Carolina, and Missouri. He's developed faith-based social service initiatives addressing HIV, AIDS, domestic violence, and addiction. He's instituted a community-wide feeding program, and he's played a key role in the expansion of a prison ministry for juveniles and re-entering adults. Next to him is Chris Kramer. He is the president and CEO of Beyond Housing, which provides services to low-income families in the St. Louis area. Beyond Housing is also operating the Vision 24-1 initiative, which seeks to organize and develop the 24 communities in the Normandy School District, and we're very glad that you are here. Next to him is Maria Chappelle Nadal. He's a person, a face and a voice that's familiar to many of you. She is the Democratic State Senator from University City, and Ferguson is part of her district. Senator Chappelle Nadal also serves on the University City School Board. She has been very vocal and active in protests and has been a vocal critic of the heavy-handed police response in the wake of the events here last August. She has been a critic of much of the governmental and law enforcement response, and she asks that the Attorney General appoint a special prosecutor in cases where police officers use deadly force, and we're very glad you're here. Thank you as well. And also here, DeRay McKesson. He has become a high-profile figure known to many of you in the Ferguson protests. On August 16th, he left his home in Minneapolis, and he drove to Ferguson. He then spent 8 days protesting. Since then, he quit his job with Minnesota Public Schools and then moved to St. Louis. The Los Angeles Times named McKesson a new civil rights leader, along with St. Louis Alderman Antonio French and another protester, Janetta Elzey. In February, McKesson and Elzey received the Howard Zinn Freedom to Write Award for their work reporting on events through social media and a newsletter. This is the movement, and we're glad that you are here as well. I do need to tell you that I'm disappointed that James Knowles, the mayor of Ferguson, who previously joined us in our conversation in August, has declined to join us as he did last time. He was certainly invited. I want to be sure that you know that. As was the chief of police, the acting chief, who also declined to join us. We asked a number of other law enforcement officials to participate, but they either declined or cited scheduling conflicts. I just wanted you to know that we did make the effort because we do feel that those are voices that need to be heard, and we are sorry that we don't have that point of view represented. And as I mentioned, that Brittany Packnett and Rich McClure, who are both participating in the Ferguson Commission, we do hope they will be joining us. The commission is meeting as we speak, and we do hope they will be joining us in the second hour. So that is why there are those two empty chairs. And with that being said, I just want to thank you all once again for your work and for your time. And I know that there are lots of things you could be doing now, and we appreciate your being here to help us get started. And Reverend Johnson, I'll just start with you, and I'll just ask, how are things? How are things?
Very much in progress. I think best way to put it is to paraphrase what Robert Frost once penned, that we still have promises to keep. We still have many miles to go before we sleep.
Okay. Chris, how are things?
Again, in progress, I think it's a great phrase. I think my fear is, as we move further away from August 9th, the willingness to have uncomfortable conversations, I think, subsides. I hope that as a region, we can continue to be in places where we have some uncomfortable conversations, because if we're not uncomfortable about how we move forward, then we're not having the right kind of conversation. So Hopefully this is a continuation of conversations where we don't have to agree on everything, but we have to be together to determine how are we going to move forward to make our region better.
Senator, how are things?
I'm now understanding what it means to be an interpreter. Mm-hmm. And when I say that in the legislature, there are almost 200 of us. In the Senate, there are 34 of us. In the region, there are 7 of us. So there are not many senators who understand what is happening here at home. And in that same sense, there are a lot of people who are on the streets every day who don't understand the culture that we have in the legislature. So every day is an educational opportunity to communicate with my colleagues, most of which are Republican, and try to encourage them to pass legislation. And what I have been saying oftentimes is, whatever happens in Ferguson is going to happen throughout the state. It's going to impact the state. So right now we have the attention of the legislature, the leadership within the Senate. When it comes to the House, sometimes there's a different story.
Hmm. Do you feel you're getting anywhere?
I do. Sometimes there's an ebb and flow, and oftentimes you definitely have to swallow your pride. And deal with the multiple personalities in the Senate and people who really don't understand what is going on here and have their own interpretation of what is going on here and have their own ideas of what should happen here. So I'm having to deal with a lot of that. And it's okay because this is the job that I signed up for. So being an interpreter is where I belong right now.
Great. I want to hear more about the different things that you're hearing that perhaps, because one of the things you're pointing out is that you're hearing from multiple perspectives, and my suspicion is that a lot of people aren't. A lot of people are hearing from the people who agree with them,
yeah,
whatever that is, and that not a lot of people are at the apex of hearing both, and I would be interested to hear from you on that. But before we do, how are you? How are things?
Are
you glad you made that trip from Minneapolis?
Definitely glad I made the trip. I think things remain tense. So you think about St. Louis as a place where the police have killed 7 people since August, and that trauma is real. I think about also sort of thinking about, what does justice mean, right? Like, justice is either never experiencing the trauma or accountability for people who initiate and perpetuate the trauma, and we would say that we've not yet seen justice. So that is real for us, that the resignations are things that are necessary and good, but not justice yet. And then the other thing that I think is important and positive is that these conversations about race are happening everywhere now, right? So before August, it was this thing where, like, middle-class America talked about race, sort of. Academia talked about race a lot and sort of theorized it. But now, like, everybody's confronted with this race conversation. Whether they have the skills to do it well or not is a different question, but they can't ignore it, right? Like, it is present in a way that I think protest made real.
I was going to ask you that. You were starting to touch on that. Has anything changed since August, other than the fact that you uprooted your own life to be here? What's changed?
Yeah, I would say that, you know, in August we were out there and didn't necessarily know each other, but we knew what we were fighting for, right? And now there's like a community has been born in protest that is just different, right? Like, we know each other's stories and names, and like there's a new community, like a new political reality of people fighting for what we deem, what we think is justice that is new. And like, we saw unrest spread across the country in ways that, like, as somebody who was out there too, like, I didn't think other cities would join us in protest, and they did. And I think that is different. That is, like, fundamentally, like, a different space that has existed, at least in my lifetime, that I didn't think would be here.
Mm. I sure would love to hear from Carlotta. Are you close to a mic? Sure, I'd love to hear from you because you also live here. You're from Ferguson, right? So, Carlotta Holt, I'm interested in whatever's on your mind, but the main thing I wanted to ask you first is what's changed since August? Has anything changed in your world?
Well, maybe a little bit. I think it's true. I think people are talking about the race issue a little bit more. But I don't know that we've all come any closer together. Because the comment that I made on my comment card, if I can go right into
sure.
it, is that, you know, you can do all kinds of legislation and you can set up policies and procedures to change the way things are done, but you can't really change deep-seated racism that exists in the hearts of people. That was already there. And actually, when the Department of Justice report came out, I was, like, really shocked, but not that surprised, to hear some of the comments that were on people's emails and the amount of racism that existed in the police department here. I suspected it, and I had heard rumors, and the Department of Justice report just kind of solidified what I already thought, but it was made apparent. And that kind of you know, that kind of bigotry is passed down through generations. And you can't change that. You can't legislate that.
You don't think so? You don't think it can change?
I didn't say I don't think it can change. I don't think you change it by legislation. I think that it's passed down through families, through generations, through the people that you associate with. You talk about most of us experiencing, you know, our beliefs through people that agree with us, and that's usually what happens. But when you grow up with generations of racism in your family, and that's passed down, I mean, all these things that we've been hearing about, you know, on the fraternity buses, the things that are, songs that are sung, and it's just amazing when you realize how much racism is still out there.
Before I let you go, and I don't want to monopolize you, and I appreciate your being first up to the mic, and kudos for that, because nobody ever wants to be first. So,
well, that just kind of opens right up the whole, you know, discussion.
Do you feel, where you sit right now, are you encouraged or discouraged?
Discouraged. Hmm. I'm really discouraged, to tell you the truth, because where I live in Ferguson, oh, technically I'm in Calverton Park. You know, it's wonderful. It's so racially mixed, and we all love each other. It's great. It doesn't exist on my street, you know, but that's not to say that it doesn't exist in other parts of town, and maybe it exists more in police departments. I don't know. It seems to, based on what you see all over the country. Maybe the kind of people who decide they want to become policemen are people who want these confrontations.
Well, you've given us a lot to chew on. Thanks for that. How about a quick thought up here? Encouraged or discouraged? Encouraged or discouraged? Thank you, Carlotta Holt. Thanks. Encouraged or discouraged? DeRay, you want to start? Encouraged or discouraged?
Encouraged. I think that, you know, black people have always sort of, our stories have either been erased, our trauma and pain has either been erased or it's been told by other people. And this is a space where, like, black people, marginalized people are, like, standing up and telling their own story and sort of pushing back against a state that has been killing people. So I think that there's only, I think that there's, like, hope there. I think that today is the 227th day of protest, and we're not going to undo 400 years of racism in 200 days. So, like, I think that there's, like, work to be done, but I'm, like, the work that has happened, I think, has been powerful, too.
Encouraged or discouraged, Senator Maria Chappelle-Nadal?
It depends on what day it is. You know, sometimes I'm really discouraged because my colleagues don't want to understand something that is so real. There, while we do need to deal with municipal court reform, it's a no-brainer. It's low-hanging fruit. There are people in the legislature that believe that that's the only solution. I am so proud of the work that we are doing right now with many of my colleagues who do want to understand and communicate the needs that we have right here, right now, not next year. We are in session for 5 months. And we're at mid-session right now. We're on spring break. And we haven't gone as far as we've needed to go, in part because of the lack of education. My colleagues don't understand what's going on here. And we're translating. They're Republicans who are helping.
What do they think is going on here? I want to read in a minute.
Shooting,
yeah, what do they think is going on here?
The shooting, for example, a couple weeks ago. What have they done now? And I had to communicate what this individual did is separate from the many of the people in the movement who I have been side by side with every single day. I don't know one person who would even think about having a gun anywhere near a great day. It was a great day for so many people when they heard about the resignation of the police chief. I don't know one person who would honestly, even if it was a mistake, would even shoot a gun, fire a gun in this momentous time. It was a big deal that day. It was a day for many of us where we were heard. Finally, the voices were heard. We need to change the system. There are other opportunities where...
So you're saying that when the two police officers were wounded on the same day that the chief of police announced his resignation, it was there they go again. Okay. Chris, what about you? Encouraged or discouraged?
I think you have to be encouraged, right? In this space, I mean, you can't get up every day and say, oh, I can't do it anymore, right? So all hope is lost. Yeah, I think you have to be encouraged. I think, as DeRay said, there's lots of centuries of inequities and unfairness and a whole host of things, and they aren't going to be turned around right away. And power is never given away. Systems don't change on their own. They're forced to change. And we're in the process of moving the force to say we need things to change, to be fair, to be equitable, to be just. And if we can keep pushing, if we can keep the energy, 227 days is great. We need a lot more than that. So I'm encouraged that there are great leaders springing up, that there are new leaders springing up, that, again, the voice of many is now being heard. There's lots of great stuff happening in this region all across the country.
Name something great.
My organization is building a movie theater on the corner of Page and Ferguson in the city of Pagedale, a community that hasn't had anything like that in 50, 60 years. And that's coupled with 4 years ago, we built a grocery store. We were in a food
grocery
desert.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't even know we were in a food desert, right? Folks just had to leave the community to buy their groceries, right? We built over 100 housing units in this community. We built a senior housing center. We're working on a lot of different kinds of things in the boundaries of the Normandy School District, intentionally saying the education of our children is critical. At the core of a strong community is a strong public education system. And yes, inside the four walls of the schools has to be done well and done right. But what happens outside the four walls of the schools? How do we support children and their families day in and day out to ensure that our children have an opportunity to reach whatever dreams that they want? So there's stories like that and others happening that if we can build on and say, no, that story that we fought the war on poverty and we lost, well, that's inaccurate and untrue. That if we have the commitment and the courage to say what's important to us, and if it's our children and our communities, then guess what? We know how to solve most of those things. We just have to change systems. And I said systems don't change on their own. They're forced to change. And we're in the middle of that. Actually, we're in the beginning of that process now. So I'm encouraged. I'm encouraged. Look, I couldn't get up every day if I wasn't encouraged. Say, let's do this again. You know, Lord gave me another day to put my feet on the ground. Let's give it another try.
Okay. What about you, Reverend Johnson? Of course, you're in the hope business, so maybe not a fair question, but...
Yeah, he put a guilt trip on me, the whole Lord
discussion.
Thing. Yeah, I'm obviously optimistic and encouraged, and while I may not always understand and may not always agree, the generation, there's a generation that has stood, come forth, and has stand up, that are standing up, and I'm encouraged by that. Particularly, I'm encouraged by the model and by the exampling. I'm discouraged because it seems more than ever before, particularly in this city, that we are much more ardent towards the change. You know, I struggle with wondering if in Ferguson, in North County, in St. Louis, if we really want to change. And that's tough for me. And it's as much as I've been a proponent to say that we need to not only invite but have those who come into the community of Ferguson or come into the county and to the state to challenge and to also take charge with us, that they should come alongside of us and not push aside. I am much more believing that the change that's going to come about is going to have to be that agitation. It's going to have to be that infusion of those men and women, that generation that is not despondent, but that's going to require us to be much more responsible and to the demands. And the more I stay in this community, the more I hear how entrenched, not so much on even just race, just how prideful we are. When we get to a place where we start defining out whether or not someone's justified not only to be here because they're maybe not a resident, but because they're not a homeowner. Those are code words, and those are code actions, mm-hmm. Coded actions against the other. And we continue, even more so than ever before. What's most disturbing, if I may say, since August the 9th, that what has not changed but has gotten worse is that we found even more ways now to distinguish out who is and who isn't here and who isn't valued here. And I'm not talking about something I heard. I'm talking about how people view me in this community. No matter how vested you are, no matter how much you offer, no matter how long you live here, no matter what you have sacrificed for some folk here, black or white, it's never going to be enough.
Do you think that's race or something else?
Well, we have a history, a footprint that is much maligned because of the social constructs that we've developed, one of them being race. Because we have this history, this historical footprint, we've had to put together these systems that memorialize, institutionalize them, and then we have adopted these practices and these attitudes and these behaviors that have become generational. And so we can't hide from that, but I always point back to that for in this community, the reason it's not just race is because people are entrenched in their power. People are entrenched in their way of living. They understand the institutions, and they only have a certain set of behaviors and attitudes that have not been challenged or that they're unwilling to reconcile with. And so whether that's race for you or your homophobic tendencies or your disposition towards people who may not have means or ways like you, or it's religious intolerance, okay, because we have spent too much time in St. Louis trying to convert folk not to Christianity but away from or to Catholicism. I mean, those are just examples of ways that we have defined out other, and we have to honor that. We have to honor that, and we have to make a decision. Do we really want to change? Not because of a DOJ account, not because it's economically and politically expedient, because it's necessary as a response of human dignity and respect.
Okay.
I'm Michelle Martin of NPR News, and you're listening to Ferguson and Beyond, continuing the community conversation. We'll be back in just a moment with a special production of St. Louis Public Radio. Welcome back. I'm Michelle Martin of NPR News. Back to more of Monday night's town hall meeting at Wellspring Church in Ferguson. I was joined by a panel of community leaders, Reverend Willis Johnson, DeRay McKesson, State Senator Maria Chappelle Nadal, and Chris Kramer of Beyond Housing.
My journalism colleague, Marky Freivogel, wrote a column where the lead she recounted a letter that she got from a longtime listener, and the lead of it was, "Stop it, stop it, stop it. We don't want to keep hearing about it," it meaning Ferguson and all the things there are. We are two white people who just want to live our lives. And it's our view that that's not a... That was the sentiment of the two people who wrote that letter and who, you know, signed their names. But it's our feeling that perhaps others share that view. And I wonder if you're hearing that. There's some people just sick of it. They just don't want to hear about it anymore. Are you hearing that? You're nodding. Yeah. Are you hearing that?
So true. So,
are you hearing that from constituents?
Yes, from people who I have gone on long walks with people who I have gone to the gym with, people who I've campaigned with. And I don't know if anyone, I've never been snubbed until Ferguson. And I don't know if your audience knows this or not, but there's an actual sound that goes along with the snub. So I experienced that.
And what is that sound?
But it's real.
It's the
there's a sound with the snub.
Yeah. And what is that? When you call up and say you want to go get some brunch, and they go, oh, no.
No, I was walking down the street in the Loop going to a literary event, and there... Two of the four people, women, Caucasian women, two of which I've campaigned with, campaigned for, and, you know, I thought it was, hey, we haven't seen each other. Hi, I'm smiling. I thought there's no problem. And I got the snub, and it was the first snub, and this is in University City, that has historically prided itself, and we're looking at each other because we're both from U City. We oftentimes have prided ourselves with being open and being diverse, but the reality is that we've had this racial conversation for years. For years, we've had on the school board, we talk about race. Thank goodness for Ferguson, the experience. Now we get to talk about the inequality in education. Thank you so much, Mike Brown. Thank you for that, for giving us a voice. You know, I don't.
But what about the people who are sick of it? What do you say? What have you said to people? Say, I don't want to hear about it. What do you say?
Well, one, I talk about white silence, and I talk about black betrayal because they're equal. Mm-hmm. White silence and black betrayal, and so I have these signs that I put together: "Stop the silence." And we're distributing them because we're tired of people who are silent at the gym or at the local coffee shop. And it's intolerable. So, yeah, I think all of us have a space, a place, and a role in the movement that we are in. And at this point, I've done three different things in this movement. I have educated my constituents on civic engagement. I have been part of the protest. And now I'm serving what I'm elected to do is being a servant and advocate in the Missouri Senate. It is very hard to have conversations with people who do not want to hear a different perspective. I've had to do research. But thank goodness for our white allies. Thank goodness for our white allies. And one of the reasons why I'm thankful to one of my good buddies who is a professor at UMSL is because he had a story, an article for me to distribute to my white constituents. And it's about bike riding. How do bikers on streets feel when they are called names? They have a right of way. They have water that is thrown at them, trash thrown at them. They also have people who are driving too close to them. How do you feel as a biker being discriminated against? And that's how I've been translating, because I've been this interpreter to legislators and to my white constituents who will listen.
I don't know if that is part of your world of people saying, I don't want to hear any more from you. If that's, I don't know that that's the majority of where you're spending your time. But how would you respond to that?
As we would all know, that the protests are not very popular to some people, right? Mm-hmm. So that is, so we experience that, like, go home, why are y'all still doing this? And the reality, like, the root of protest is confrontation and disruption, right? That is, like, what it is. And, you know, to the people who are sick of it, we're sick of living it, right? We're sick of being killed. So part of protest is, like, is sharing the pain, right? Like, we will distribute the pain and share it because, like, we are experiencing a trauma that is not only so real but so consistent, right? So that is one. The second is this thing about our burden is never managing white guilt, right? Like, as marginalized people, that is not our role. It is, our burdens are only justice and freedom. But that the corollary to that is that white people can be disruptive with their privilege in ways that I can never be, right? And I think that this space has been really powerful because I've seen some white people, like, use their privilege to disrupt in ways that not only are necessary, but, like, but have allowed the movement to move in places that it couldn't. So I think about when we sat in the police department, if 20 black people had walked in to the Metro Police Department, it would have been on the moment we walked in, right? But 20 white people were able to walk in and take up space in a way that black bodies couldn't, right? And it was, like, a great example of white people using that privilege of, like, just being nobody asked a question until, like, we were all in there, and then they're like, what just happened? But there
you're talking about one of the Black Lives Matter demonstrations or one of the
we occupied the police department in St. Louis City. Mm-hmm. But it goes back to this idea that, like, yes, we know people are tired. I would be tired, too, if I had this, like, privilege that I didn't earn, but that allows me incredible comfort in life, right, that, like, other people are pushing back on, and that is what's happening. But again, like, we are also tired. We're tired of dying, and protest is sharing
but
that.
But what do you say to people who have that privilege of not having to think about it, but who still, say, have the most votes in the legislature? What do you say to them to make them interested in that? Do you feel that you have to? Do you feel like you have to be interested? You know what I mean?
I think the frame is, like, everybody has a different role to play, okay, right? So, like, Maria's playing a role around protest that, like, is not my role, right? So I'm not at the meeting because we're putting the message in different places. But I do think that is, like, the root of the disruption is making people feel, sort of confront the issue of race in places where they would not have to. So at the grocery store or in the Loop or, like, all these other places where, like, ostensibly they can operate in this comfort and privilege and would never have to experience it, but we're going to bring it to them. And we believe that, like, some of that is actually really important, and it sets people up, like Maria, to do different work, right? That, like, we've never said protest is the answer, but we've always said that the disruption is what might lead us to a solution. Does that make sense?
Well, that leads me to a question which a lot of people, because we've been asking people all day what questions that they have, and one of the questions for the protesters is, why are you still protesting?
Right, and our response back is, like, why are the police still killing people, right? So it's this thing of, like, you know, we would much rather be somewhere enjoying life than fighting for the right to live, right? Like, we don't protest because it's fun or, like, because it's, like, the new cool thing to do. We protest because, like, because we had been so silent for so long, and this was, like, a way to confront the system in a really visceral way. So I think that, like, you know, the reality is people will go home if they had experienced some justice. Like, so, you know, Chief Jackson resigning and getting a year's worth of pay is not justice to people, right? Like, that's not justice, which is why people...
What's your end game? Yeah. What would... Not that I'm inviting you to go home. That's not my role. But what would constitute justice for you? What would be your end game? What would be something that would feel like a victory to you?
So let me frame this and say that, like, you know, when I think about all the things we've learned from the civil rights leaders, like, we've talked to Diane Nash and Bernard Lafayette and those people, is that they sort of thought about the wins as these, like, very concrete things, and then they sort of moved on, right? And one of the things that we have been thinking about is, how do we think about the wins as, like, phased things that we know that, like, desegregation and the Voting Rights Act didn't, like, fundamentally, like, erase racism, right? Like, it still existed. So how do we think about, like, having successes in ways that we can experience the thrill of a win, but not think that it's over, right? That, like, and we don't get fatigued by fighting often. So that's, like, the frame. I think that there are a lot of things. I think that, like, not speaking for all protesters, but many would say, like, a disbanded police department, right? Or, like, Mayor Knowles not being mayor, or, like, the officers being fired, or anything happening to the others. Like, there's six other people who've been killed, and we don't know anything about their investigations. There's been no accountability in any of the, you know, So any of that stuff, again, if we think of justice as either never experiencing the trauma, which is white people, right? They don't experience the trauma. Or you think of justice as, like, accountability for people who initiate and perpetuate. Like, we just haven't. That is not what we've had. We've had these things where we've been, like, teased with justice, right? Like, it's like the, we're going to have people resign so you think something happened. And we're like, mm-mm, which is why people were out there the day Chief Jackson. It was not a celebration as much as a recognition that, yes, this is important, but we're still out here shutting down the street because this is not justice. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. Thank you for explaining that. What would feel like, do you feel that justice is coming? I know that this is not, do you feel or that there's progress being made? And what would feel like justice to you? What would feel like progress is being made to you?
Honestly, I don't know. DeRay has eloquently explained that we are on a journey, and there's a whole lot that we have to address. And one person, I did say this previously, three people are not the reason for or the cure-all for the problems of a system that is not only local but national. And that is endemic of humanity. We are just totally disrespectful and disregard, have great disdain and disregard for other. And this sense of this problem of disposability. I mean, like the brother said, Mike Brown is just one in the summer of 2014. In the summer of 2014. There have been others already this year in the first quarter of 2015. And I mean, yes, we want people to stop shooting, black and brown young people. I want people to stop shooting each other. I want people to stop shooting cops. I mean, it's not an issue about just black men, black boys, Latino men. And so I commend the brother because the reality is we are all in a different lane of trying to address, translate, agitate, challenge a history, a system, and a cultural dynamic that, for the most part, has now become necessary, as we perceive it as people, for our survival. I mean, we need the system to be the way it is, because now, in the legislature, they're worried about our municipalities going to go bankrupt because we changed the structure around predatory ticketing. We're worried about whether or not we're going to have to share our police force with two or three other municipalities. This idea of self-preservation and territory, I mean, I don't know. It's complicated, like Facebook. It's complicated.
I feel you. All right. Well, let's hear from some more folks. Jen, what's on your mind?
Well, thanks for taking my question. I teach sociology at a local community college. A lot of my students are going into criminal justice. We have a lot of discussions about Ferguson. I know that a lot of them are very critical about what's going on in Ferguson. I want some advice that I could take back to my students to talk to them about what they can do as future police officers and future law enforcement to help support community.
Well, it's interesting. I do hope in our second hour we will hear from people from the I will say again that we invited a number of people from the law enforcement community to join our conversation, as they did earlier, and unfortunately we were not able to have that participation, so it would be interesting to hear that perspective. But from the standpoint of people here, it is an interesting question, because can I just share an interesting observation that, you know, I was here last week on Thursday to attend a journalism group. And thank you for your question, Jen Klein. And in preparation for that, I was looking up the coverage of earlier civil rights eras. And one of the things that was fascinating to me is how many of the local news outlets never interviewed the protesters at all. So you could read the entire story and hear only from elected officials or law enforcement about their perspective on what the protesters are doing, but you never heard from the protesters at all. And it is obviously very different now. What's different now is obviously you have your own means of getting your story out through social media, and you also have, I think, a news media that's more interested in what you have to say, I think. But what we've been hearing from some people is that they feel that the law enforcement perspective is completely missing, that nobody understands where they're coming from. Nobody understands where they're coming from. So go ahead, Senator Maria Chappelle Nadal, what do you think?
I am so glad that that person came up and talked about what her students can do. My discipline is sociology. It's the understanding of human behavior. Why do people do what they do? That is the question in
sociology. Especially in groups. I'll out myself as a sociology major, too.
You have to ask yourself those questions. And, oh, by the way, my mom taught criminal justice for like 15 years. And she always said, I never thought about this. I was about 8 or 10. And she would always say the most difficult students she ever had were police officers. But really, in sociology, what is important is understanding why people feel the anger, or why do they feel as though they can carry all of this authority with a gun? Why do they feel this way? You're asking yourself those questions. Why is it that Darren Wilson did what he did? What kind of background did he come from? Now you understand it because you know a little bit about his background. But you also understand how he felt being in this community, his background, the lack of education for people across the board. It doesn't matter if it's law enforcement, because there are protesters out there who have allowed police officers into their homes without a warrant. There are people who have been hogtied. There are people who have been called monkeys. There are people who have been called animals. There have been people who have had their entire humanity taken from them. When you have a grown man crying in your arms because there was a 5-second rule and he had a cane and he was out every single day in his chair protesting for his rights, for his civil rights, for his constitutional rights, for his human rights, and then there's all of a sudden a 5-second rule where he can't walk consistently because he has a cane, you understand the hurt and the pain inside that man who is crying in my arms. I had not ever held a grown man cry before. So you ask yourself, everyone should ask themselves, and be fair about it. Why are the protesters out? What is the feeling that people have? What has been happening for so long that has been swept under the rug consistently? And as we were talking about earlier, Ferguson is no different from New City. We have a black side, we have a white side, and right in the middle, it's mixed. But you talk about race a year ago. Oh, we're doing this, we're doing that, but we're really not. Now, after August 9th, we are.
What about her question to what? I think she was asking for people who are interested in law enforcement, what would be your message to them?
It is absolutely important, especially with the Philadelphia report that came out today, that law enforcement get the type of education where they do not have to make the decision who is going to be covered by the Constitution. Everyone has a right, has a pathway, is defended by due process, has the right to due process. I think that's important. But, you know, that's a good question because I have some really good friends who are police officers. And I have to tell you, we've sat down and we've cried together over this Ferguson experience.
Can I ask you, while we've got you, and DeRay, I want to ask you this question, too. Actually, I'm interested in all of your perspective on this. Is, do you accept the Department of Justice's analysis of what happened? There are two different reports here. One did not press charges, bring civil rights charges against Darren Wilson because they felt that he did not engage in behavior that would warrant federal civil rights charges, but also a second report that made some very pointed critique of the police department here and the municipal courts here. Do you accept their report as valid? Do you agree with their findings?
I think those are two different questions.
They are two different reports.
So, yeah. First of all, I do not agree with the report dealing with Darren Wilson and not having a pathway for suit. That is number one. But I think there is a lot missing in that case. And until I'm not a law enforcement agent at all. I didn't go to school for that. But what I wanted is justice for this community, and they didn't receive that in that report. In a different report, they were validated. This community has been validated. The people who have been crying out for generations at a time finally have justice served. Finally, their voices have been validated by this report. And that is a win. That's one of the wins of many that we probably are going to have in the future.
What about you, DeRay McKesson? Have you read the reports by now, or both of them, right?
Yeah.
And your reaction?
So I'll quickly answer the advice thing. I think that so first, we are not anti-police. We are anti-police brutality, right? So, we know people will be police officers. I'm not convinced there should be a Ferguson Police Department, so I might be anti the Ferguson Police Department. But in general, not against police. In terms of advice to people, one is acknowledge acknowledge it, right? So I think about, I've been at conferences and things and have seen police chiefs from around the country who will off the record be like, we know what you're saying is real. But on the record, it's like they are just defending the crazy system. And we're saying that, all we're doing is telling the truth. That the truth is actually so damning, all we need to do is tell it. And I would say people going into it, there has to be this acknowledgement that, you have to say what's happening is real. We didn't make up the video of Eric Garner, right? That is not we didn't imagine that pain. That is real. The second thing is, figure out how you – I'd be interested for officers who are current officers or people going into it to think about different ways that they can push the system from within, because that's what we don't. I've been in a million conversations and I've never been in one with law enforcement sort of thinking really deeply about what could be different structurally. And Brittany just joined us, and I know I got a chance to be at some of the 21st Century panels, and it was interesting to see some officers start to struggle through sort of what could be different. And I did read those two reports. And I think that I'm interested in the panoply of options that have existed in those spaces. So I would ask people to look at those and sort of push the profession. In terms of the report, so the DOJ report about the deep injustices around race and how the Ferguson Police Department existed, black people didn't need a report to validate that experience because lived reality validated that before the DOJ came. With that said, it is true, right? So appreciate that it's true. What I've seen now is that it's actually given cover to a lot of the media who stood by the protesters in August and got slammed for being biased. And now they're like, nope, see, I was right, right? And I've appreciated that. With the one about Mike Brown, I am okay with their finding around the civil rights piece, right? But I'm still ready for a trial, right? That report to me has nothing to do with his criminal responsibility. I'm ready for the evidence to be looked at by a jury. I'm ready for a trial, so I can be okay with the DOJ saying that he didn't meet the standard for the criminal rights violation. But in terms of the criminal charges of murder, I think that Darren Wilson should still stand trial. That report has no bearing for me on that process that we are still hopeful that he can experience.
Thank you for that. Can we hear from another member of the audience? I think that's Shoshana, right? Shoshana, go ahead.
Thank you so much for hearing from me. I am a high school student, and I attend a very affluent high school in St. Louis, and it's mostly white. And we really pride ourselves on being active in the community and being progressive and liberal and ready. But I was disappointed with our response, and I feel like I have an important role in communicating with other young people. And I've just seen a lot of young indifference, and I'm wondering how you think we can engage more youth.
Well, I want to hear more about that. Why do you think that is? Because we all think you're all going to fix it.
We hear that a lot. And I just found it concerning that people are, like the senator said, tired of hearing about it. And they feel like, things are getting fixed now magically. But really, the impetus is on us to continue to do this work.
Can I ask you, before the events of last August happened and all the other things that, because a number of our guests have pointed out that what happened here in Ferguson is certainly not the only thing that has happened in the country, and certainly not since then. Before that, were your friends, classmates talking about these issues?
Very minimally.
And what about now? Do they talk about it at all, or are they sort of saying, I'm over it?
People are pretty over it. They're tired of hearing about it. And even teachers at my school who say that they facilitate these amazing discussions are at this point just saying, look, we're not going to talk about it. We have, class to cover, and this isn't as important.
Thank you for that. But we haven't really answered your question. Shoshana wants to know, what can you do? What can you do? Who wants to answer that? What can she do?
Well, I think one of the first things you can do is just, there is a collective humanity around the story, right? It's not just a data collection. It's not a whole host of other things. These are real lives are being impacted every day. And if you kind of remind your peers of the humanity around this, right? Can you imagine yourself in the shoes of fill in the blank, right? Can you imagine again what that would feel like every day to have the weight on that? Of that on your shoulders every day? And what would that make you feel like? And wouldn't that drive you just a little insane in terms of every day, because of the way you look, you get treated differently and unfair? Again, this is not an abstract conversation. This is real life that happens today, each and every day in St. Louis and across the country. And again, it's not going to get any better unless those of us on the outside who say, that's not really me, I'm not really doing that, I'm not an overt racist, I'm not doing anything like that. If we remain silent, if we remain on the sidelines and don't understand, this is somebody else's humanity and this is somebody else's life, and it is unfair and wrong, and it is correctable. And it will take all of us to get it done, right? So, yes, it's a little abstract because we've done a great job here in St. Louis and be able to, I'm going to live around people who look just like me, and I'm good with that. If I go to work, I may see some other people look a little different. I can chit-chat, and I can go back home, and I'm just like me. Press them to get out of that space because that's not what the real world is. And there are real-life human beings who have fears, who have hopes and aspirations just like them, that don't have that fair shake, that don't have that same opportunity. And when they go out every day, their life is so much different than yours and mine.
Chris Kraemeyer is the CEO and president of Beyond Housing. Thanks to our panel for this first hour of Ferguson and Beyond, continuing the community conversation. It was recorded on Monday night at Wellspring Church in Ferguson. Our panel of community leaders included Chris Kraemeyer, the Reverend Willis Johnson, DeRay McKesson, and State Senator Maria Chappelle Nadal. Tune in tomorrow to hear the second hour of this forum. Two additional guests will be joining us, Rich McClure and Brittany Packnett of the Ferguson Commission. This has been a special production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.